Welcome to UK Health Radio. You are listening to the Speech and Language Therapy Show, hosted by Shamina Rabi, a consultant speech and language therapist and founder of Unlocking Language, an award-winning independent practice that provides speech and language therapy to both adults and children. She is dedicated to raising awareness about speech, language, communication and swallowing difficulties and empowering those who have them.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Speech and Language Therapy Show on UK Health Radio, your good feel radio. So today I thought I would talk about what actually is speech and language therapy, as each week I've always got a different topic to cover. But often when I tell people that I'm a speech and language therapist, or they ask me, what's your profession, what's your practice about, and I tell them, well, yes, I'm a speech therapist, or we provide speech and language therapy services, I often get the response of, ah, what's that? And people straight away assume that speech and language therapists only and solely work with teaching people to speak around elocution. And yes, we do that, but we also do a lot more, or it's to do with stammering. Well, that's not just it. There is so much that speech and language therapists do. And 2020 is a really, really special year because this year, our professional body, the Royal College of Speech and Language Therapy, celebrates 75 years of speech and language therapy as a profession. Woo! So, as speech and language therapists, we work with so many types of people, so many types of conditions. And today, I want to go into more detail about the role of a speech and language therapist and how you can get into the profession, talk through my own journey, talk about how speech and language therapy has changed and evolved over the last few years. And to kind of shape this conversation, I thought it would be a bit strange and really a bit difficult if I did it myself. So I've asked one of the directors who works at my practice to come in and help me shape this conversation, take over my role and ask me the questions, and I will sort of be a guest on my own show today. So welcome, Mr. Mohammed Wasi.
It's great to be here. Really excited to learn about your journey into the profession. Yeah, so why speech therapy? It's not one that stands out. So it'd be interesting to kind of learn about your journey and why you went into speech therapy.
Okay. Well, it's really interesting. So I've wanted to become a speech language therapist since I was 12 years old. I mean, who knows what they wanted to do at 12, but ironically, I did. So my mum, an immigrant in this country, one of her first jobs was as an interpreter because she's very talented with languages. She can speak 7 different languages. And so I was exposed to languages very, very early on in life. My mum is from Tanzania, and as I said, she could speak 7 languages. And my dad is from Bangladesh, and he could speak about 4 languages. And so I was exposed to rich languages right from birth. And she, one of her earlier jobs was an interpreter, obviously with her talent of languages. And she came home one day and she was talking about, it was dinner and we were eating. And she was telling us about a client that she had seen that day and that she'd met a speech and language therapist and that it was a very interesting role, and talk through what the speech and language therapist was doing. And then a few times after that, over dinner, she would talk about the speech and language therapist again. And I would be thinking, wow, that sounds really interesting, because sort of by 12, I loved languages. I loved biology, like how the body works. And I was also quite interested in the mind. But I didn't really want to do medicine. So when Mum was talking about this, I thought, wow, that sounds really interesting. And she actually organized some work experience. I think it was just a couple of days at the age of when I was 12. And so I went in and shadowed the speech therapist and I loved it. And I thought, right, this is what I want to do. After that experience, I thought about doing other things, as you would, you know, you sort of change your mind about careers, but speech therapy sort of still stuck there. And, you know, when it was time to choose my A-levels, I chose subjects that were relevant, so biology.
I mean, just for your listeners, I'll be honest with you, until a few years ago, I didn't know what speech therapy actually was. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in the same position. You know, before you continue on that lovely narrative, would you mind just for your listeners, just to tell us what actually speech and language therapy is?
Okay. Speech and language therapy is a very exciting and a very varied career. It really does give you the opportunity to make a difference to a person or a family's life. We, speech and language therapists, provide assessment and treat children and adults who have difficulties with either communication, eating, drinking, or swallowing. So I'm going to talk about communication first, because I think when I talk about swallowing, most people are like, wow, you work with swallowing as well. Speech therapists work with communication difficulties across the lifespan, all the way from birth with babies, all the way up to a gentleman who might be 102 years old with severe dementia and has difficulties to communicate. So we work across the spectrum. So I'll just sort of talk about children and then move on to adults. So with children, we work with children who have speech difficulties. So that would be articulation, where there are problems with pronouncing sounds, the clarity of speech. Then we work with children who have language difficulties. So that's when they've got difficulties to process, understand language, put words together into a sentence. And very commonly now, we have a diagnosis called developmental language delay, which is when a child has... well, their primary concern is the ability to understand and use language.
So one of the misconceptions with speech therapy is it's to teach languages. Could you just clarify? I mean, it'd be an interesting point to clarify, more than just language.
That is right. So you're right. Often people think speech therapists are interpreters or part of that team. But you're right. We're not there to teach you you know, your native language or to better your English. We do better your English, but when there is an actual cognitive and learning and processing difficulty with being able to put language together.
Sure.
So yeah, that's a really good point, because often we've been asked, oh, so you know, you're here to help with interpreting, or could you teach me to speak English better? Or I may have EAL friends who'll be like, oh, could you help me with my English? But you're absolutely right. It is more around the components of language.
Yes, because correct me if I'm wrong, but this is a fully fledged undergraduate degree, which is, which I believe is 4 years in length, isn't it?
Absolutely. So there are only a handful of universities that actually do the degree. And it's either a three and a half or 4 year degree, depending on where you go to study it. And it is a very complex degree. So I did it as my undergrad. But there is also a postgrad route, which is 2 years. Again, it's intense. And you've got to be able to sort of fulfill the criteria. It's a very competitive degree. You'd have to, it's recommended to have a degree before you do your postgrad, and then have quite a bit of experience in the field of speech therapy.
And I'm guessing it's that length, because like you've already mentioned, you're looking at the human biology and how that kind of links into the communication capabilities of an individual. In terms of that spectrum you mentioned earlier, would you just like to go into that spectrum?
Yeah, absolutely. So I talked about when we're working with children, there's the speech element, which is the motor speech area. Then there's language. And then, of course, we do work with stammering, and that's across the spectrum, children, teenagers, and adults. And then with children, again, we work with any, if they're born, with physical disabilities like Down syndrome or cerebral palsy, their muscle tone is affected, which impacts on their ability to be able to speak. And we work with those clients. We also work with babies, toddlers and children who have cleft lip and palate, because I'm sure you can see that there's a huge link with speech. And so we work, you know, sort of pre-surgery, during and then post-surgery. And there's a lot of work that we work jointly with the multidisciplinary team. And that's one thing that I love about speech and language therapy, because no matter which condition or client group you're working with, you're always part of the multidisciplinary team. So you're in schools or you're in the hospital. You know, let's take, for example, the cleft lip and palate client. You know, you'd be working with the nurse, the surgeon, the doctor, perhaps even a play and music therapist. So it's very humbling, and it's something that we really enjoy working together with other professionals.
It's a collective,
bringing it together.
It's quite a collective kind of effort in terms of treating your patient.
And then continuing with the spectrum of sort of conditions that we work with. Again, with children who are born with quite significant needs, or who may not be able to, unfortunately, you know, verbalize, we work with AAC, so that's alternative augmentative communication. So that's where we're setting up different ways to communicate. So it could be using an app on an iPad. It could be that we need to work really closely with the tech team and the occupational therapist to set up an actual, you know, computer system that would work for that child.
Would that also include British Sign Language?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or is that a separate element?
No, you're right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, sign language, Makatone, that is an alternative way to communicate. So yeah, that would fall under that.
Because obviously it's quite prevalent, and that's the one, you know, the general population are probably more aware of. But obviously it's fascinating to learn that there's so many other communication methods you know, available and out there in terms of...
Absolutely. Symbols, pictures, you know, communication books. There are developing gesture. There are so many ways to you know, for anyone to be able to communicate. And that is what communication is about. It is empowering that person to be able to communicate their needs. And then, you know, we're also involved again to work with children who may have a diagnosis of dyslexia. So we're working on the phonics and the sounds. We're working with a dyslexia specialist. And then something that's quite big at the moment and that people are quite familiar with is autism. So we have quite a massive role there, because, you know, often most children with autism will suffer from some sort of speech and language deficit or social communication difficulties. And again, that's something we're involved with, which is social skills, developing and consolidating those social communication skills.
Slightly digressing from your spectrum.
I could go on. I'm really sorry. Yes, absolutely. There's a huge list here.
Just for a moment, dealing with the autism element. Now,
okay.
The autism word... you know, it's sometimes the elephant in the room, but have you seen a marked increase in cases that, you know, even coming to your clinic in the last few years, whether it's increasing or whether we have there's a better reporting mechanisms to record these cases?
There definitely is an increase. I started speech therapy in 2004, and I remember we had quite a few children on our caseload, but I would say majority of the caseload now, there are red flags around autism. And I think there are two things going on. One, I think there is definitely better awareness. I mean, you know, literally everyone knows about autism now, what it is, what are the signs. And sometimes there's over-awareness. So I am getting parents calling up. They've got a two-year-old or a three-year-old who's not really playing with others, who's not speaking much, who's not really listening. I think my child's got autism. Actually, most 2 and 3 year olds can do, you know, it will behave like that. I've got a 3 year old, a 4 year old that behaves very similar at times. So I think there's a lot of awareness, and there's perhaps a lot of anxiety around it. But then on the other side, I do think that there is there is a prevalence in autism. I'm not sure what the cause is. I'm not going to blame anything here, but I do think that communication has changed. Unfortunately, we're in an era where a lot of communication is done, you know, via the phone and via the computer. A lot of tech is involved. And I think those opportunities for really meaningful conversation are not there anymore, or are not a focus, because we are all so distracted, unfortunately, with our phones. I'm not saying that's the cause. I think that's a contributing fact. Okay, so should I carry on with this
yeah,
ongoing list?
By all means, carry on with your with your spectrum. It's fascinating.
Hearing impairment. So you sort of touched on that with sign language. So we do work with, you know, people who have got, who are either deaf or who have got hearing difficulties, not only on developing sign language, but actually on developing their speech, because they can still talk and they still want that ability to be able to verbalize while they're using a different way of communicating. And then we work with adults. So in terms of adults, we work with
so that was your sorry to interrupt mm-hmm. but well, that was your adult spectrum that
pediatric
sorry
yeah the children
excuse me, your pediatric spectrum that you just went through
and there's a lot more I could add, like working with children who've got mental health and selective mutism. It's just so
it's wide, that speech and language therapy. It's quite a narrow field because you're dealing with the communication and language element of, you know, human interaction.
Mm-hmm.
But then this spectrum that you've gone through, it's just fascinating to learn there's so many different elements within.
Absolutely, because, I mean, like you just said, it's communication, and communication is, you know, we don't really think about the way we speak. Have you thought about the way you... where speech comes from, or the way you use your words or your language, or
we
being
take
bilingual.
It for granted, don't we?
Absolutely, like breathing and walking and eating and drinking. But it is, it's such a complex process. And I would need a whole nother episode just to talk about that, or have a scientist come in and actually talk about that. So going on to what adults do, what we do with adults. So we work with clients who have acquired communication difficulties. So this is if they have suffered a stroke, or they have a neurological condition like Parkinson's disease or motor neuron or dementia, where their communication has been impacted. So for example, a stroke client might have developed difficulties to pronounce certain sounds, and also unable to formulate a sentence, and that's aphasia and dysarthria. And so, yeah, we work with acquired communication and difficulties following neurological diagnosis of an adult client. We also work with adult clients who suffer from dysphonia. So that is an actual voice disorder. So it's when there are difficulties at the vocal cord level. The vocal cords or the vocal folds are the two muscles that are required for voice. And when there are difficulties around that area, clients will develop dysphonia, and we will work on improving their voice and trying to get it back to its baseline. Adult therapists are also more medically involved, because they are working in hospital settings. So we will work with clients who have tracheostomies, who are on ventilators, and actually speech therapists are very highly specialist in this area because of our knowledge around the larynx, pharynx, and the throat area, and the speech area. We're working very closely with the ITU team to wean someone off a tracheostomy. So that means sort of, you know, getting the tracheostomy, which is a external tube attached into the throat to help the person to be able to breathe. We're also involved with laryngectomies. So these are clients who suffer from cancer and unfortunately have to have their larynx removed. So an evolving role for speech and language therapists over the last, I'd probably say, 20 plus years has been working in head and neck cancer. In fact, we speech therapists now run head and neck clinics jointly with a specialist nurse, and because there's so much we can offer these clients, because often enough their speech is affected. We're also involved with so when we talk about medical field, you know, we're involved in acute, so when you know, the client has had an accident, and it's a very acute phase that they've just been diagnosed with something, all the way up to rehab, where they need more active rehab and they're not as medical, their medical status is now stabilized. So we have a role with clients who have spinal cord injuries, really any medical client that needs speech and language support. We also work with learning disabilities. So that's often when the person is 18 plus and they've obviously had ongoing problems since the time they were born. And as adults, we are still involved in their care. And again, that's communication and ensuring that they can communicate the right way. And something else that's evolved over the last sort of 20 years has been working with offenders. So speech and language therapists are now in offending teams and in prisons and in the courtroom. So in the courtroom we act as intermediaries, where we support the client to be able to not advocate, but we support the client to be able to understand the situation that's going on during the case. And with when working in prisons and in the offending teams, it's to aware that that person has got a speech and language problem and that has impacted on their behaviour.
Right. Okay. So that's a really broad spectrum that you've just described. Now, the obvious question, if you're to draw a parallel with other professions, like for instance, if you qualified in the law, you would specialise in a specific area. Mm-hmm. Do speech therapists specialise in a specific area of that spectrum, or can they be multi-skilled?
That's really interesting because in the UK, it's a little bit more split. You either do adults or paediatrics kind of straight away when you come out of university. When I graduated in 2004, I was very fortunate because at that time in the NHS, they used to have mixed posts. So my first post was mixed, where I did 3 days adults and 2 days paediatrics. But nowadays, the way it is done is that either you go into adults or you go into working with children. But in other countries such as Australia and South Africa, you can work with both, with adults and children simultaneously.
And does that, in your opinion, does that bring additional benefits, having the ability to treat both adults and children?
Yeah, I would like to see more of that in the UK. That was the route I took. And in my practice, I will work with certain disorders with children. And although adults is my forte, I do work with speech difficulties, speech delays, language delays under 5. And I think that's because of the experience that I had early on in my career and sort of was able to keep that up. And I think it gives therapists the opportunity to be able to, often you might be a fully fledged adult therapist, but you like one or two conditions that you can want to treat and manage in pediatrics. So I think it gives them the opportunity to be able to do that. And there are a lot of transferable skills when you're working with either population.
Sure. And in terms of the undergrad element, because obviously you did the undergrad in speech and language therapy, do you have an opportunity to cover the whole spectrum, or is there certain elements that are more specifically covered?
On the degree,
on the undergrad?
I think it covers everything very well. So I studied at De Montfort University, which is in Leicester, fantastic place. And my degree was 3 years and a term. And the reason it's so long and intense is because, there's so many different areas to cover. So there's learning the linguistic element. You really do need to understand how linguistics work. You often are on the course with linguists. You need to understand elements of psychology, the theories of counselling, the theories of language, and so again you are jointly on the course with psychologists, and again that's what I was saying, sort of right from the start of the course you have a couple of modules that you share with other health and medical professionals, we really do need to go into detail about the muscles around the mouth and the throat and leading to the stomach, because we are specialists. Can I quickly talk about swallowing, because I've actually missed that out. the list of things that we do. So I'm going to talk a little bit about swallowing, if that's okay, because I missed that out. But speech and language therapists do work with swallowing difficulties, eating, drinking, and feeding difficulties across the spectrum, again. And the reason I think that sort of fell into our field was because we were experts around, you know, we are experts in communication, and those muscles and those parts of the body that are used for communicating are the same that are used for eating and drinking. And I think that sort of slipped into our forte over the years as speech therapy has evolved. And so the medical term for swallowing difficulties is dysphagia. So, you know, we do study that at undergrad level, but once you qualify as a speech and language therapist, we have to do some additional work to be able to become fully competent in dysphagia, because it is so medical. It's got very serious consequences, as I'm sure you know. If you can't eat or drink, then there are serious consequences there.
So with dysphagia, so you're talking about these are life and death situations. So
it can be, yeah, it can be. So if somebody has got a significant swallowing difficulty and they need to remain nil by mouth, because that is a judgment call that speech therapist.
So that's a lot of pressure that you're dealing with there.
I wouldn't call it pressure, because I'm passionate about it, and it's you know, it's part of the role. But yes, that, you know,
is it just second nature then? It's just part and parcel of the job. You don't really think about it, because for somebody sitting here listening to this, and who's not in the medical the health profession on the front line, everything is quite a daunting aspect of your role, which is, okay, you need to make the right call in terms of somebody's swallowing difficulty, or
you're right in that sense. And I think that's what differentiates therapists when they want to kind of work with adults, because they do want to do that frontline medical decisions, you know, working with the medical team, putting someone on something safer to eat and drink, reducing that risk of choking. And then you have therapists that perhaps don't want to be so heavily involved in the medical aspect of things, but again, you know, have completely different pressures and challenges working in another field. I think that gives me a really good idea for perhaps doing a podcast around dysphagia and the challenges of working you know, as frontline therapists. Yeah.
So you are obviously, because you're making these frontline calls, which are you know, obviously very important and significant, I'm assuming you are, speech therapy is a regulated profession.
Absolutely. So once you graduate, you have to apply for a license to practice, which is with HCPC, the Healthcare Professionals Council. And you can also, I mean, it's advisable to also be part of your professional body, which is the Royal College of Speech and Language Therapists. You are regulated by HCPC, and that they ensure that you are keeping up to date with your CPD, because, you know, medicine is changing all the time and evolving, and speech therapy is part of that medical and health field. So as other therapists, other AHPs like physios, OTs, it's a regulated profession.
Sure. So in terms of that evolution of your profession, so obviously you graduated in 2004.
Yes.
It seems a very long time ago.
Yeah, it is a long time ago, yeah.
To what it is now in 2020, what's changed within your profession, and is it for the better?
Yeah, definitely for the better. I mean, I think anything that's in the medical and health field is always for the better as it evolves, just because, you know, medicine is evolving. And, you know, if you think about kind of clients that we work with who might have such severe speech and language that they need another way to communicate, we are in the era of tech. So all the apps now that are available for our clients is fantastic. IT software that's available is just, you know, at a completely different level to what it was in 2004 when I graduated. There are so many ways to communicate now, and it's so more accepting to be able to communicate non-verbally, because, you know, I'm sure you and I probably, you know, text our friends and family a lot more now than we would have in 2004 when we would have picked up the phone and spoken to them. So definitely in terms of the tech side of things, it's, there's been a massive evolution.
That was actually, you just preempted my next question, sorry to interject, but it was going to be, while you're dealing with the tech element, my next question was going to be whether there's space for technology and tech in the modern day healthcare profession. But sorry, carry on.
Yeah, and you know, the answer to your question is absolutely. I think that, you know, it's a really exciting period and that we can really support our clients with more bespoke ways to communicate because there's just so much out there. And there are some fantastic speech therapists in the NHS and independent providers that focus just on developing that technology. And another thing that I think that has really evolved over time has been the general awareness and rise of our profession as speech and language therapists. So I feel in 2004, when I used to, you know, be on the wards and going to see clients, people weren't necessarily, including the multidisciplinary team, weren't always aware of what my role was. But now I feel that, well, now I know that when you are studying to either do medicine or other medical professions, you are taught about who the members are of the multidisciplinary team. So there's a lot more awareness of what speech and language therapists do. There's a lot more awareness around referring to them and making decisions together and working together. So I feel the respect of all health professionals has significantly got better over the last 10 years.
Because speech therapy, from my understanding, it falls within the allied health professions. So that's your, obviously the speech therapist, your occupational therapist, physiotherapist, to name a few. And obviously the most famous amongst that grouping is probably physiotherapist, because more people probably require physiotherapy than they would speech or occupational therapy.
And that makes sense because, you know, physiotherapists can work with anybody that has any sort of physical need, whereas speech therapist is a bit more niche because you'd only really come to see the speech language therapist if your communication is impaired.
Sure. Okay, so, but in terms of, okay, so from a personal perspective, so the 16 years you've been involved in speech therapy.
Wow, that's long.
Yeah. It does sound a very long time. So in those 16 years, have you had to kind of adapt your approaches? For instance, obviously the technology element has come in. You've probably had to adapt, you know, how you do certain things. But in terms of the approaches to dealing with, you know, some of your cases, and have you had to adapt to that? Or
yeah, that's a really good question because I think in the last 10 years, not only as speech therapists, but as healthcare professionals, we've questioned what is evidence-based. So I feel that most of what we do now, you know, it is evidence-based. We're thinking about, right, where has it worked? What are the case studies? What are the numbers? Let's do this. Whereas I think earlier on in my career, not everything was so evidence-based, but it kind of worked. And that is medicine, isn't it? You know, that is how we diagnose and treat. We just know this is what it is, and we know this is the treatment for it. And I feel speech therapy, there's a lot of questions that have been asked by speech therapists, like, why are we doing this? What is the reason for this approach? Let's look at the numbers. Let's pilot it somewhere and see, what the end result is. So I feel that everything is a lot more evidence-based now. And again, I think that really, that helps towards the credibility of what we do as speech therapists.
Sure, absolutely. It's interesting because obviously dealing with your kind of journey in speech therapy, obviously, I know that you sort of initially started out, like most therapists do, in the NHS, working in the NHS. And, after a number of years, you moved into private therapy, and then you're now running your successful clinic, across the country.
Okay, so I always say this to all therapists, and I say it to my team now as well, that it's really good to work in both. Either start off in private and then go into the NHS, or start off in the NHS and go into private. But having experience of both is really important because, for example, So in private practice, it's fantastic to be able to be at the same school every week. Start your day there, end your day there every Monday. You're part of that school team. You're training the staff. You're meeting the parents. You're delivering the therapy. You're doing the assessments. That's fantastic. Working in the NHS, you get the opportunity to basically see whatever comes through the door and deliver a block of therapy. And that skill of kind of working under pressure is something... diagnosing and working under pressure with sure. so many different types of conditions is something you would get from the NHS. So I think they both have a lot to offer. But I do want to break the negative perceptions of working in private practice. I think aspiring therapists often think I'm not going to be given the right supervision, the right support. But actually, the supervision structure is equally as good.
Yeah. I mean, what sort of, like, for instance, in private practice, as compared to the NHS, or not even compared to the NHS, tell us more about what an aspiring speech therapist at your practice, what sort of support mechanisms would they be given?
Band 5, so that's the starting point of a speech therapist, has a certain supervision structure in place, and that is deployed at both the NHS and private practice. So wherever you are, even if you're working solo in a mainstream school that's hired you, or a hospital setting, there is a supervision structure that follows. I think people have a negative perception that because it's private, you're not given that support and structure, but that's completely incorrect. The same support and structure is given because we are regulated as speech therapists by HCPC. So we have, we've got to be able to support our team. And of course, it comes back to accountability. If I'm getting band fives to see clients who, and go into schools for a paid service, I need to make sure that all my therapists, whether they're a band five, a specialist, a highly specialist, or a clinical lead, have got the toolkit to be able to deliver the services. Supervision, CPD, training opportunities, these are all provided for therapists.
Okay, that's great. So coming back to your journey into private practice, I thought it'd be quite interesting for you to explain to your listeners, how you came about going from one therapist, which was yourself, mm-hmm. To now managing, a practice with upwards of 25 speech therapists.
So that has been a very interesting journey, a very challenging one, but one that I've really enjoyed. The degree, as I said, is very clinical based. So they don't teach you those skills of really running your own practice, which is essentially running your own business. It is a small business, and I'm part of the small business community in the UK. So those skills of, asking for money, negotiation, managing people, managing relationships, writing contracts, none of that was on my degree. And actually, I didn't really have an opportunity to do much of that on, during the first sort of 10 years of my career. So those non-clinical skills were very challenging. I did make lots of mistakes on the way, as any sort of entrepreneur or business owner would when they start something new. I've absolutely loved it. I've loved all the challenges. And I think I've enjoyed that jump from NHS to independent because it gave me something else to learn from. Yes, I love my clinical side, but I've really enjoyed the business side to this because I was a complete novice.
Yeah, sure. So in terms of obviously leaving the speech therapy element to one side and concentrating on the business side of things, I'm assuming you've had to wear many different hats. So, like, if I give you some examples, so you must have times worn that legal hat to deal with contract negotiations with potential clients.
Yeah.
The HR hat.
The HR hat is very hard.
Yeah. The HR hat, the finance hat, the marketing hat. The facilities hat.
Yeah.
You have to market, changing of that light bulb.
Yeah.
Which one of those hats, have you, obviously now that the team's grown, you've filled out in terms of those, that side of the business as well. But which one of those hats do you secretly, still want to keep and you kind of miss or has been the most enjoyable, let's say?
The branding hat. So kind of thinking about marketing your business, who to market it to, how to market it, what's the niche. Because if anything, it's made me realize my own self-worth. It's made me realize, you know, just how amazing speech and language therapists are, the amazing work that we do. And it's not only helped me think about branding Unlocking Language, but actually branding the profession, because we do so much. And that's one of the reasons why I got, you know, sort of my relationship started with UK Health Radio, because I wanted to really raise the profile of speech and language therapy and get it out there into the mainstream because of, you know, the amazing things that all my colleagues do in the UK and around the world.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely great. So in terms of that branding, actually, in terms of that raising of the awareness of the profession, what sort of activities have you engaged in to raise the awareness? Apart from UK Health Radio, I know that you're actively involved in the community.
Do focus on raising awareness of speech and language, particularly in the Asian community, and in particular in the Muslim and Bangladeshi community where we are based in Tower Hamlets. Growing up, I know that there have been a lot of negative perceptions and misconceptions of disability, of hiding the child who can't communicate, of feeling embarrassed, thinking back to the Burko report that was released in released in 2008, where he actually identified that there was a significant need in speech and language within areas of poverty, and in particular Tower Hamlets, an area that I've grown up in, an area that's very close to me. And so, yeah, I do a lot of work with parents and families, a lot of free work out there. We have a great relationship with a charity based in East London that provides support that will pay for some of the sessions for families. We're in the realms of organizing a SEN conference for Muslim parents so that we can talk about what is available. And actually, let's talk about this. Let's talk about disability. Let's talk about speech and language difficulties.
I mean, these events, obviously, they sound incredible, but the reason I suppose you're highlighting, a minority group is because the Burko reports identified that as a grouping or groupings who are disproportionately impacted. Mm-hmm. So obviously everybody is welcome.
Yeah, and getting parents to you know, get help and not feel embarrassed or have their child or spouse in hiding because they're not unable to.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
They're not able to communicate.
Absolutely, and obviously it's where the awareness may be lacking, because I, for my sins, have actually read the Burko report, both iterations, both the 2008 and the report 10 years on.
Mm.
And, it's quite clear that in those communities, the awareness is just not there. And, would that concur with the experiences you found as well?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's getting better. I definitely think it's evolving, in all communities across the UK. I think that people are, starting to be more accepting and mental health communication difficulties is coming on the forefront. And, mental health and communication are closely linked. If you've got mental health, it's difficult to communicate. If you can't communicate, you probably will have some mental health issues. I think across all communities, that there has been a rise and people are asking for help, but there's still a long way to go.
Sure, no, absolutely. I mean, it'd be a shame not to mention the next element, which is, some of the work you've done and the practice has done has obviously been recognised. And, I can run through a whole array of awards you've won over the recent years. And a couple of the initiatives, but just on those awards, receiving those awards and those accolades, how does that make you feel as obviously an individual and on behalf of your practice as well?
I always say teamwork makes the dream work. It's I have to attribute all my awards to my whole team, everyone from our interns, our volunteers, you know, our other directors, the speech and language therapists, everyone that puts in that real cohesive effort to make it work. Yeah, I mean, it's very humbling, it's very humbling, but I'm pleased that speech and language is recognized, you know, amongst other, it's a very humbling, speech therapy is such a field that you don't necessarily get recognized for all the great work that people do. So I think it's been a really great way to acknowledge who we are and what we do. And, you know, winning accolades and you know, recognition is, as I say, you know, teamwork makes the dream work. So it's everyone in my team, from the directors to the interns, the volunteers, the admin staff, and of course the brilliant speech and language therapists I have. And I'm really lucky that I have some speech therapists that started with me very early on in the journey and who are still with me and who will hopefully still be with me over the next few years.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in terms of that, obviously the awards, I mean, they're quite amazing. Not to forget some of the other initiatives you've personally been involved in, it's worth highlighting, especially, you know, raising awareness of female entrepreneurship in the Asian community. I know you're involved and you were a finalist for the Asian Women Awards, and you're actually an ambassador for them, and you go to various events to try and encourage people, you know, to come into the profession. Tell us a bit about that.
That's right. And I do really enjoy that side. So again, you know, it's one of your questions where you asked, you know, what sort of skills and things have you learned and had to pick up? You know, that entrepreneurial side I've thoroughly enjoyed, and I am still thoroughly learning all the time. I'm part of the Asian Women's Achievement Alumni. So once you are shortlisted or a winner, you then are part of the Women of the Future scheme, where I am an ambassador, and that involves inspiring young women from all communities, but in particular the BAME community, to be able to inspire them to go into medical and health professions. And so I do go to talks and I talk about my journey as a speech therapist and then becoming an entrepreneur. Sure.
Okay, that's really fascinating. I mean, in terms of the responses you get, you know, do you find it's a mixture of, you know, those who are interested in the profession, but those also who might find you quite inspiring in terms of an entrepreneur? Do you separate the two, or are you a soul-trepreneur?
No one's ever called me that. I don't separate it. I think it's about inspiring girls to think outside of the box. So no matter what career you are in, I think you can be entrepreneurial. Entrepreneurial is about great ideas. It's about implementing those ideas. You don't have to have a private practice to do it. You've got entrepreneurs in the NHS. You've got entrepreneurs in corporate. You've got social entrepreneurs. You know, it's about being entrepreneurial in the career that you decide to choose.
Currently involved in, or you've been selected, inspiring female business leaders, and every year there's a publication of 100, and you've made it onto the list for 2020, so congratulations on that. But that's more that's not limited to a specific group.
No,
that's open.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a campaign that has been set up by Michelle Ovens, an MBE in small business enterprise, and it celebrates. I mean, the goal of the campaign is to celebrate the dynamic and inspirational businesses led by several women in the UK, and it's learning about the business leader's journey into the business, learning from the stories, the challenges and the success. And there's lots of kind of events and storytelling to showcase, you know, these inspiring women. And I'm really, again, humbled and, you know, really pleased to have been selected on the list. And again, you know, I think it is because, you know, speech and language therapy is not rare, but it's, you know, we're still raising awareness of it. And so I think when they hear the story, you know, of someone who has tried to be entrepreneurial with speech and language therapy, you know, I think it really rings a bell to people, you know, really it tugs at those heartstrings. And I think, you know, people feel, wow, this is something really different and really unusual. And I'm really pleased because next week is International Women's Day, and all 100 women, including myself, have been invited to a breakfast at the House of Lords, where we will be talking about females, female entrepreneurs, and women in business. So again, it's a fantastic way to network and meet wonderful other inspiring women.
Well, that's an amazing kind of initiative, and you know, once again, congratulations on making it to that list. I think the time has approached us to say goodbye for another week.
Well, thank you, Mohammed, for filling in for me today and giving me the opportunity to be the guest.
No problem.
So thanks for coming in, and to my listeners, I will be seeing you again next week, back to my position of interviewer or host. So until next week, have a great week. Bye-bye.